It's Sunday the 23rd of September 2012, and I'm here with, I'm sorry, it's Carolyn Sturdy, but now Carolyn...
Scales.
Carolyn Scales, the niece of Daphne Oram. So the first thing I'd like to ask you, Carolyn, is could you just give me a brief outline of the kind of family tree from Daphne's parents' generation to your own, if that's not too complicated.
That's okay. Her father was James Oram, and mother was Ida Merton Talbot, and they lived in Devizes, and they had three children. The oldest was born in 1916, and that was Arthur, and then my father, John, born in 1920, and then Daphne in 25. So they were evenly spaced.
Okay. And then...
Do you want to know anything more about Jane? You don't want to know anything about parents? No, I didn't
say
so.
Well, I was wondering if you could sort of... And
a bit more.
Yeah, to go down to...
Okay, and then Arthur had four children.
Wow. Okay.
And then I've got one brother.
Right.
Yeah. Who's got two children.
Right.
They both met Mick Garrison.
Yeah.
And obviously Daphne didn't have any.
Yeah. Okay.
So there are some great, there are, from my uncle Arthur, there are she's got two great nephews and two great nieces on that line.
Yeah. Yeah, and John and Arthur are both deceased, are they?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. And could you tell me what's your earliest memory of Daphne?
Well, I can remember earliest memory is meeting her in Welbeck Street when she lived there. At the time when she was moving to Tower Folly.
Right.
Because probably one of my earlier trips to London.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remember an almost empty flat.
Right, okay.
But
she was in the process of moving out, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. There's quite a lot of correspondence, I think, about that flat with the...
She was sharing it, wasn't she, with some other people?
I'm not exactly sure what the details is, but certainly I've come across correspondence where she's kind of quite pissed off about how it's going.
I think when we got up there was something, definitely when we went in there, there was something that should have been turned off or something like that. Or there was something which was wrong, not quite as it should have been.
Yeah.
Did she seem happy to be moving? Excited to make the move?
Quite honest, I mean, what age was I at the time? When did she move? I can't remember.
I think it was around the same, it was 57, 8?
Yeah.
Well, I was...
58, I think.
I was born in 1950.
Yeah, so you were pretty small.
That's amazing that you even remember that.
Yeah. And then after that, did you often visit Tower Folly? Have you been there many times?
We did visit Tower Folly. Particularly, we used to go in the summer. We used to go onto the continent, and we used to camping, and we used to go use the Dover route. So we used to go and stay the night on the way down.
Right.
And there was, it was always you went in and you just incredible atmosphere of things happening, and she was always excited. I don't know, I was. Young teenager.
Yeah.
You know, it's always this excitement. She always had something that was, she had to come and see, you know, straight away it was saying, come and see, you know, I've got this idea, I've got that idea. It was all very, although I didn't understand it, you just feel this electric atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah. Are you musical yourself?
No.
No, okay. So it was quite out there for you, as it were.
It was more of interest to me from the mechanical side.
Yeah,
musical.
Yeah. And did her and John often get together and talk about, because they had a business together, is that right?
Yes, they did.
Electronic Studio Supply Corporation or company. Yeah.
Oh, yes, they used to be on the phone together. And obviously they developed John designed and made the basics of the Oramix machine.
Yeah, yeah.
And he obviously had to. I can almost remember him, vaguely remember him saying, "Yeah, what do you want?" And trying to make sure that he was going to. He was making something that was what she would want for a long time, realizing that her, obviously, being siblings, understanding that her ideas would develop, and he almost had to sort of second guess what she might want on the machine further down the line. But yes, that's he did all that work, and the special clutch.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter how much, film was on the reels and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was all his work.
Okay. Do you remember seeing the machine in operation?
Oh yeah, I wiggled
the light and everything. Great. And
it didn't sound like anything. Daphne was very disappointed. Both my brother and I tried, but.
Oh right. How do you mean she was disappointed with your efforts?
That we didn't make something
more exciting
noise out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So could you sort of tell me in as much detail as possible about using the machine and what you saw and what how it ran?
I would have been 10 or 11 at the time. What surprised me when I saw it in the Science Museum, it seemed very small.
Right.
From what I remember. Yeah. I just had this feeling of it almost filling the studio fully.
Yeah.
And it just seemed very small, but it may be that there was so much equipment around it.
Yeah.
But all I remember, apart from being given a pen, make the marks on, I can't really remember much else about it.
Right.
And I can remember going down there one Christmas and she had Holly and the Ivy going.
Wow.
Continuously. And then she changed the waveform on the oscilloscope in the billiard room.
Yeah.
And that could change the tone. And I can remember her telling me about the waveform and how she'd love to make the sound coming out of the machine to sound, say, like a flute or something.
Mm.
But actually, that's just too difficult.
Mm. Right.
But
okay.
She was very interested. She seemed at that point very interested in trying to make it produce different tones.
Yeah. So would that have been on a loop then, or do you remember seeing reel to reel kind of?
She had
lots
of reel to reels. She had reel to reels around.
But I mean, on the actual machine itself, did the film transport?
No, this was in a different room. Discussion was in a different room.
Right, right.
So I don't even know if it went with the Oramix machine.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
So this would be sort of
1960,
roughly.
Yes,
60, 61. Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
I only 10 or 11. So
yeah, yeah. No,
this is probably, strongly looking at this machine and the dots, going in and watching the dots going backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes it went slowly at some point.
Yeah.
And coming in, I can remember Daphne talking to me. But,
Was it always, did she kind of always have it on? Was it something she was constantly working with?
Oh, yes, it was always, when you went there, life was around the studio and things.
I wonder
about. Give her back, yeah.
Yeah. Well, something I've been thinking a lot about with Daphne recently is whether she regarded herself as sort of an inventor of instruments or whether she regarded herself as a composer. Because it's interesting you mentioned that piece of piano music, there's a thread to some of her work where she's very clearly a composer, like the advertising work and the scores for Still Point and things like that. But that, to me, is quite a different thing to inventing a new instrument and a new sound, in a way.
I'd have to know the answer.
Yeah, just it's an intriguing thing.
One thing, particularly my brother always says, is that she always wanted to be able to hold her head up in going to being in the sort of lecture circuit. You're going and speaking at the Edinburgh Festival was probably very important to her.
This is what I kind of get the impression of that you know, she looked at, say, what was going on in Europe and in France and wanted to be amongst those people as as a kind of artist in her own right, I suppose.
Yes.
I was going to say, she definitely always writing to people in that kind of official capacity.
Mm.
It's one of the things she always mentions is that, and I've given many lectures and demonstrations, and she wants to be kind of seen as a consultant in that respect, I think, definitely.
Another interesting is that later on in life, she visited my parents one day out of the blue and left some tapes there.
Right.
And those tapes were the tapes she used, or copies of the tapes she used, at the Edinburgh Festival.
Right.
I don't know if there's any of her own music on them, but I know most of it's other people's.
Mm.
But why was that? Why were they the tapes that she asked my parents to look after?
It's interesting. Not her own compositions. Mm.
I'm of the opinion, and it's kind of something that has not really been quite uncovered in the archive yet, because it's quite difficult to get access to it. But I think her advertising work is astounding, and from what I can work out, it would seem that she just didn't really care about it. Like, she was just doing some jobs for money. But it appears to me that as a composer, she had an incredible way with sound, with editing and working with material. And her ear was incredibly sharp and inventive in that way. And it's quite sort of... Because I can't get a hold of the... I've been trying to get a hold of the films to match up to the audio so that I can watch the kind of 30-minute adverts for, you know, there's a dog food company she did one for that's totally brilliant sonically, but all I've got is the storyboards and trying to work out, like, those little sketch drawings. But, yeah, it's difficult to get hold of them off the companies, but I really want to kind of put it all together, because I think there's actually a bulk of work of her composition there that sort of hasn't quite all been put together yet in a coherent thread as such.
Well, I think this is what... I mean, she was just so dynamic. Mm. She had this, I think, this very composing, but she was also so pushing forward that she wanted to make her own machine, the Oramix machine. She was also, that she was thinking, right, she may, just guessing, it may be, well, okay, I can run off this advert and that will pay for my next so many months in the studio or that piece of equipment I really want to buy. She may have looked at it in that way, but actually some composers a few centuries ago did as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's quite likely.
For living or whatever. Yeah. The rest might have been living and looking after their family, but they just needed money. And actually it was just simple for them to run off.
Yeah. In her correspondence with the Gulbenkian Foundation, she mentions that she needs to spend less time doing commercial work and more time... She says she'd like to spend more time lecturing and more time developing the machine. So those obviously were her priorities as far as she was dealing with the Gulbenkian Foundation. Or if she didn't believe that herself, that's certainly what she wanted them to kind of believe. But I think that probably was her motivation. Do you know?
I think it's that. You know, you can't have new music without new instruments, really. Mm. It's that approach to composition that is really valid. Like, it's completely true.
Mm.
And that's why I'm sort of so interested in the kind of difference between inventor and composer in that realm, because she's a really good example of someone who's kind of completely both, but yet the public focus on her is really as an inventor rather than a composer. There's not like there's not yet been concerts of her work, I suppose. Not as kind of programs of it, and there's some great stuff there. I've just had the still point score digitized, and hopefully I was talking to Dominic Murcott at Trinity about having it performed.
Well, that'd be great.
Hopefully he might notate it and do it, because it's a bit beyond my scoring abilities.
I mentioned to you earlier about the fact that Oramix never really became a commercial product, or was never kind of released in any kind of... It was always a prototype, and as we've already discussed, that it was her, you know, kind of main focus of activity for a long period of time. But do you have any ideas about why it might be that it wasn't more kind of, why a product wasn't released, or why it wasn't generally more in the public eye, or basically why a product never came out? Do you have any opinion about that?
It was probably never perfect.
Yeah.
Because I think she was a perfectionist.
Yeah.
Like her brother.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they were. She just wouldn't have put a name to it.
Right,
unless it
was
perfect.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I mean,
one of the
how
things,
could you have made another one? I mean, it was
in
the expense. I mean, how much would it have cost? It's not something you could have mass-produced in that format. Because later on, she looked at a simpler format, didn't she?
Yeah, that's what I was referring to, really, the Mini-O-Remix, which would have been... which would have been the natural progression to something you could sell to schools or studios or something like that, which I know she was interested in. There's evidence to support that very much. And there's a design, actually, which I'm looking at in quite a lot of detail at the moment. But and I think the design is kind of, from my limited knowledge of electronics and mechanics, which I'm better at electronics, but it's viable, I think, although I'm having numerous teething problems already, as she probably did. But I think if you had a backer, like a big backer, like Decca or RCA or whatever, it would have been possible to make a product. So,
it would be wonderful if you could.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah,
that's the dream. To have. I mean, Daphne was always interested in schools and getting her ideas out into schools and teaching everybody to listen to sounds around them. And that would be a dream come true to me,
right.
to produce a school, school's version of their own machine.
Yeah. That's the plan.
While we're still talking about Mini-O-Remix, did your father at what point did he stop working on or stop helping Daphne with it, or did he, or did it just carry on forever that he was constantly
It was just after the start of the O-Remix machine.
Just for the first kind of couple of years?
Yes, Then he just had to get on with his own stuff.
Because then she kind of had a series of people that kind of came in and helped her in various different ways, I think. Kind of Norman Gaythorpe and the other couple of people, Graham Ranch and... over the course of her kind of lifetime work like this.
Could you tell us a bit more about, I'm sorry I forget the surname, but you mentioned Martin, the young assistant, who, I'm sorry, I wasn't really that aware of him before.
Well, probably just better talk to, Mick about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
He'll probably introduce you to him.
Great. Okay. Yeah. And did you meet Norman Gaythorpe and Graham Wrench?
Graham, yes.
You met Graham?
Yeah. Because Graham was working at the same time as my father, actually.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been building a chronology of... it's taken a while, but of every item in the archive, so where I can date something, I've been building that, and then I wonder if maybe I could send it to you.
Graham did an article in
Sand.
Yeah, so that's Gibbs when he finished working for Daphne.
Yeah, there's a couple of bits that I'm a little bit unsure on where dates seem to clash, which I don't know, it may not be something that... have any knowledge of, but just on the off chance, because it's kind of, when you're doing something like that, it's really nice to try and iron out.
While John was developing, Graham was working after we delivered the basic on Christmas, I think it was. We went down for Christmas to Tower Folly, and that's when we took the unit that my father, the mechanics, that's when we took it down, and that then Graham was there then.
To fit the electronics to it,
I can remember. I think I can remember him then.
It's a enduring mystery why they stopped working together, and I don't suppose you have any further comment on that.
Not really.
Not really. No. Yeah. It's yeah. Mick mentioned to me that Graham said he would take the story of that to his grave, so it doesn't seem likely that anyone will ever find out about that. But it's a yeah. So it's an interesting one. Because
there's family mysteries.
Yeah, there's so much positivity actually in her early correspondence with the Gulbenkian Foundation, that basically Graham's the saviour of the project, and it's coming along much, much faster that he's working on it, and that they're almost, she talks about it as an equal partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think she's, you know, she's still in charge, kind of, but she's very much talking about them talking about it as equals and as collaborators. Yeah. And so it's, yeah, I think that will be an enduring mystery, but it's an intriguing one. And really, I think that it was the main, you know, that couple of years where, 2 or 3 years where he was working on it, was where the major progress was made, I think, in terms of getting the time base and everything to work properly.
It would be lovely to be able to go back to be able to go back to that point.
Mm.
And then work forward again.
Yeah, yeah. She had, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm doing in a way, research wise. Yeah.
What in Tower Folly? It was a 14 bed house. Is that right? Was it that many?
No.
No, it wasn't.
No, that was, how big was it then?
Well, there's the actual Oast House.
Yeah, I just wondered where, the Oast part, how the Oast, she occupied part. The whole thing.
Well, the Oast part was, the ground floor was her studio, which was round, obviously.
Right.
And the room above was her bedroom.
Right.
And the room above that, if I was very lucky, we went to stay, I was allowed to sleep in that room. And then you went up to the top, which was just a tiny
little place. So is it just big, round, circular?
It was... I mean, it's so difficult. I would have said it would be this sort of...
Yeah.
Right.
A bit smaller, maybe. It's got to be smaller.
Just drive up there and go.
There were plans.
You want to go, you can drive right past it. Yeah. Right on the road.
Yeah. Mm.
And
still be
that,
there.
I've forgotten her name, who lives there now, who came down to visit. She didn't invite some issues.
And then there was a room next door which had a big billiard table in it.
Mm.
And up above, in the early days, she used to have students from something Macmillan Teachers Training College, which was somewhere nearby.
Right. Oh, she had, and she had them staying for like week-long courses. And
No. They were college. They were college students.
Right.
So they that's where they lived.
Oh.
As lodgers, kind
of. As lodgers, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And she had one, the room
that
above.
That makes loads of sense. Okay.
That's maybe where you got the number of rooms, and that was just more or less a dormitory.
That's where I was getting confused, just because.
So maybe she had 14 people at once.
Because there's a sort of, there's a little gap in correspondence where, in my head, the courses she was running had blurred with these people living there slightly, I think.
I didn't know she ran courses.
Well, she did a couple of electronic music courses,
right.
And I had assumed that I'd have gone on for longer with more people over a longer period of time, but obviously.
I think when she first moved there, she used to take him to help run. I mean, it was a big house.
Oh.
Then at the back, you went into a room, and again, yeah, I was young, but there was grand piano over there, over in one corner, and there was an upright piano, dark, good upright in another corner, a big table, a few chairs around, and that's where you ate, and then you went round to the back, and there was this awful lean-to, huge lean-to, and that's where the kitchen was.
Mm.
But between these two parts, there was a vestibule, and in there she had one of those pianos with a roll on it.
Oh, really?
Did she
had
a piano? Like a player piano.
Yes,
yeah.
And we used to sit there, when we went, we used to take the rolls out of the cupboard full of rolls.
Wow.
Put them on there and then play the.
That's a precursor to kind of Aramex, really, the player piano. Certainly part of that.
Pianola.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
She wanted another piano, and she went to an auction, and nobody bid for this piano. and she obviously played it a bit and decided what we'd do. She couldn't understand why nobody else to bid for it. And then at the end, they said, well, yeah, we'll take it away. And then she discovered what it was and how heavy it weighed and what it cost her to get home. But they did throw all these rocks in with it.
Well.
So what happened to all her pianos and they just got sold?
You'd have to ask Martin Cook.
Yeah.
Because he cleared the house.
What kind of piano she had.
He cleared the house out.
Did she play a lot?
I don't know, because when we were there, she'd been too busy talking.
Yeah.
All her ideas and everything. So I don't know how much.
That sounds like a great room. Grand piano and up, right? And a player piano next door. That sounds brilliant. Sounds ideal.
When you got fed up, you went to play billiards.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the bit on the side was a single. I was just thinking how many other bedrooms there were.
I think there's a plan. There's a plan somewhere in the archive. I can't remember exactly where. But I got some other info about that from this chap, Oliver Barnicote, who's I interviewed as well, who actually got in touch with Mick and said that he'd been to visit Daphne during the kind of more computer years, like in the, I think in the late 80s, early 90s. He was based in Kent and he was obviously the son of this family friend, Bunny. And he described a few things to me.
I can't remember. I'm just sort of trying to think where bathrooms were and things like that, but I've got no idea.
No, it's a sort of detail that evaporates, isn't it? And the same with places I was at when I was younger. But I'm pretty sure there is a plan somewhere. I've certainly seen one.
I think it was something I accessioned quite early on, maybe a couple of years ago.
Probably just go and knock on the door.
Yeah,
very far away.
But people rearrange houses, don't
they?
You never
really
know.
Not very far, is it?
Yeah, maybe we should go. I want to go and interview Graham at some point soon as well, so I might rent a car, but it's the wrong direction. He's in Norfolk, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, Suffolk.
Suffolk, is it? Right.
Yeah, that would be good.
But it's not that far from Borough Green and places like that.
I had a question for you, actually, from the head of the Electronic Music Studios here, which is if you know where Daphne's buried.
Her body was given to science.
Oh, was it? Okay.
So we never... I had said she didn't want a funeral.
Right.
So her body was given to science, and we had a memorial get-together. I met you there as well. I met you twice. At Rootham, at the pub in Rootham.
Right. That's really interesting.
Was that so? Was she religious at all? Was that in line with any kind of belief system? Or
well, I mean, I don't think you'd call it a traditional religious view. But her philosophy to life was
I just wonder because it seems when she was younger that she was relatively religious, but it's quite hard to tell something like that from what's there.
No, because her father was a very strong Congregationalist.
Mm. And to some extent a spiritualist, or is that...?
Yes. There is that, definitely in the family, there is that interest.
Yeah. Because there was a period of time in the sort of 70s and 80s where she was heavily interested in that sort of era that was going on everywhere at the time, New Age thought, and it's odd now because it's like, actually, that was the first time that I'd really realised that era existed, because these days people have somehow seemed to completely ignore that bit of time in culture as if it didn't happen. But it's so fascinating that it happened everywhere.
Also, it was a repeat after the First World War.
Oh, right.
In the 30s, wasn't it? 20s and 30s, you've got the same thing. All it's done is it's just repeated.
The 30s was into spiritualism.
Ouija boards and all the rest of it.
And all these people.
It's odd because it is something that I had not really realised.
Yeah, your elder brother was talking to the...
Arthur.
Yeah,
Arthur.
Mm.
Daphne's elder brother was we found it quite difficult to find a church where we could have a service for his funeral. He was a member of the
A spiritualist society or something like that.
Yes, but it's called something that sounds a bit like a physical. Physics something of the society anyway.
Metaphysics?
Not metaphysics, no. He was a member of something or other society. I'll try to find out.
I think.
The thing is that so was their father's, James was interested, but there were people, and that was what they were interested in. And I think being an inquisitive family, they did look at everything as children and everything. They didn't.
I think it's.
And it sort of has it's just come full circle.
Mm. There's at that time in the kind of music world, in the avant-garde music world, there's a lot of that. Like, if you look at Karlheinz Stockhausen in Germany, and there's a huge wave of thoughts like that, which is funny because the way it's written about now, that whole thing is sort of blocked out because it's so kind of not. It's not in vogue to think like that, I suppose.
Yeah. It's psychical research.
Psychophysical
research.
I think it was psychical research, yeah.
Yes, he was a member of that society.
Right. Because I saw there's a membership card for the Research into Lost Knowledge organisation that she was part of for a while, which is Sir George Trevelyan, who's kind of quite a big-ish spiritualist.
Right.
But she appears to have gone through a phase for about 3 or 4 years, possibly after a kind of incident of carbon monoxide poisoning at Tower Folly. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
No, I'm not.
But where she
could have been quite easy because that back kitchen was a death trap. There were open. It really was old. There were open, really old open sinks.
Right.
I mean, you really felt even as a 10-year-old. I was going back 100 years.
There was a
sort of one tap something. And I think the hot water came out of a big geyser thing.
It
was
in need of an update.
Yes.
As they say on there.
And I have a feeling that could easily have been. And I can vaguely remember a really old-fashioned gas cooker.
So I think it's documented that was definitely the case, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sometime in, was it the very early 70s or late 60s?
I can't remember the dates.
We can check if you're interested. Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah,
I just wondered if there was anything else that sort of inspired, because what's quite noticeable is that it's almost like there's a certain point where I think she became quite dissatisfied with what was happening with Aramics and the way it was going.
Yeah.
And had sort of run out of options funding-wise.
Mm.
So almost just switched and took a completely different approach all of a sudden, which the only event I could see to mark it was her going to hospital briefly with carbon monoxide poisoning. And then she kind of, for probably a couple of years, is attending every kind of parascience conference and everything of that ilk going, really. And writing to all the heads of these organisations and, going into that world. And then suddenly, just as quickly as she started doing it, she's back out again into writing research papers and back on the Aramics machine a few years later. And it's just quite kind of...
No, I didn't know. It's this is odd, new to me.
Yeah, it's sort of an odd period of time that I can't quite work out, I suppose. A lot of her correspondence stops for that period of time as well to the people that she was writing to before.
It's almost as if she was trying to clear her brain and start again.
Exactly.
Which is... Yes, as a niece, I'd understand that. She's always saying, look, I can't think straight about this, or where she was going maybe.
Mm.
So she might have just done something totally different, used her brain in a different way, and just sort of some reason or other picked up what was around her in her childhood again, and just looked into that.
Part of me suspects that it was like a research project in itself. Yes. She was... she was looking for the healing powers of sound before that point, and looking into kind of psychoacoustics and these sorts of things, and there's the Pyramids book and work about that, and resonant frequencies run throughout the world and that sort of thing. And I don't think there's any way to ascertain whether or not she was completely kind of like she was enraptured in that world, or
whether she was taking it as a study. Yes.
Because some of the letters are quite kind of, you can almost see that she's just trying to extract information out of the people rather than being part of it as such. But, it's very, very interesting, actually. It's almost like she's sort of spying on
them. It's like a thorn in their side.
Yeah. But
I could imagine her doing that, yes.
Right. Because with her father having those interests as well, it's kind of like, she's probably kind of half-half a little bit, I suppose.
Like, there's a piece of writing I found, I mean, I think she certainly believed in more than what science would tell you is the truth. Like, I think that's certainly fair enough to say. Yeah. And there is a piece of writing somewhere where she basically says, well, if people in, say, 1700, I can't remember, I'm paraphrasing, but if people in 1700 had, if one person in 1700 had the knowledge that we have now, they would have burned him or her as a witch, kind of. And she feels the same about science now, that there's so much more to learn that. So in a way, she had a science, you know, I should finish that, you know, but if someone now had the knowledge of what we might know in 300 years, then, it's a similar sort of a situation, and that she doesn't consider her research into things that might be viewed as parascience or metaphysics as being non-scientific avenues. There's certainly a piece of writing, I would struggle to put my finger on where exactly it is, but there's, and I think that's a perfectly scientific attitude, actually.
Yes,
it's not kind of crazily out there. And I think many people feel, you know, in a similar, you know, feeling.
My guess is that that would have all been discussed at home, because remember, her eldest brother was 10 years older.
Yeah.
So when she was sort of 10, my father would have been 15, and the eldest brother would have been 20. And I'm very aware that during school holidays, they certainly, the two brothers, used to do experiments, chemical experiments and things.
Yeah.
They used to scare their mother when she opened the gas, what she'd find in the gas oven, when she opened the door, she'd find some experiment cooking there.
Great.
And they did one, as a way of showing how during her childhood they were looking at things, was that one summer they spent the time, sorry, I can't remember the name of the piece of equipment, but you have a pendulum with a pen, and it can make beautiful
sound. Okay.
And then you can make harm something or other.
Monograph. Yeah.
And then you can have two pendulums. You can make even. Well, those three. Not only would they have tried to set it up, making beautiful patterns, but what they would have then said is, right, how can we, if we work out, they would have questioned it the other way around. If we do such and such, or if we want to make a certain pattern, you know, how do we do the pendulums? And then they probably then say to each other, right, if I do the pendulum such and such a way, and another one the other way, what pattern will we end up with? So they're really looking around, not just, they'd use something like that, not just to do pretty patterns, but to actually question what was going on and what was behind how these patterns were being produced.
So
do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
that really echoes.
All three of them probably.
Yeah, that very much.
The two brothers would, and the sister would be watching on.
That very much echoes the pattern of how she saw the sound wave on the oscilloscope screen, and then immediately thought, "Well, let's reverse engineer that," which was the kind of that very much echoes that way of thinking, which is, as far as we understand, how she conceived or amid.
And my father had a huge Makana said that she always wanted to play with, so apparently he was really mean to her. Sweet. He used to make, once if he had something that he wanted taken to pieces, then she was allowed to play with it. She had to take it to pieces first. And there she would have learned an awful lot about gearing.
Yeah.
Had incredible, I've got a photograph of the set, and there was a lot of gears and things, so she'd have learned all that.
Mm.
I say she was certainly taught to use the lathe that the brothers had. And one day I can remember being at, just standing and watching my father working on his in his workshop at home, which was down in a cellar, and I was standing on the bottom step watching him. And he said, turn around, he said, you just remind me of Daphne, that's what she used to do.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling what Daphne managed to do was to persuade him to let her do the same thing
that
she learned. Whereas
he
wouldn't have had the time
to
have shown me enough to work again.
Yeah.
But certainly there was, I think the three of them, and probably she even got even more out of the two brothers because of the age gap.
I can almost
imagine her thinking, they went to boarding school, and I can always imagine her looking forward to school holidays and what exciting things they're going to do.
Yeah.
Where did your father and Arthur go to school?
Bishop Stortford.
Right, okay.
But certainly he used to come back and do all sorts of things.
Mm. So they all boarded and then came back home on holidays?
Yes, they would have done that. And my father did things like he when he got to get his... No, this is a bit off the subject, but it does give you an idea of what Daphne was seeing.
Yeah, that's all important.
There was a big lawn in front of the house, and they had a kind of push mower, which the only way, well, my grandfather and local coal merchant's business, and had a brickworks as well. And none of the family could push this mower, so they used to have a man up from the brickworks to push it. They had to come
a burly man.
From. Yeah. And so they were down on holiday in Cornwall, and this my uncle told me this. They were walking along the cliff top, and my father said to his father, "He knew if he motorised this mowing machine, would he, and mowed the lawn three times, I think it was, could he then have a lathe?"
Yes.
And he knew where, somehow or other, my father got where somebody had an old motorcycle, and he used a motorcycle engine. Now, I don't know anything about engines, but apparently what you want for a motorcycle engine is not what same sort of...
gearing and
everything.
For a lawnmower.
Well, anyway, somehow Robbie got it to work.
Well,
he did it and he got it to work and he mowed the lawn three times and that's all.
Okay. There's business acumen there. That's a. Yeah.
But you know, that Daphne would have seen all that happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Give you a bit more sort of background.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's really good. And I you mentioned that you knew a lot about her childhood and stuff. I mean, if you can just expand upon that or tell us any other information about her influences and things like that. It's all really crucial.
Yeah. Well, I would have said the music was from her parents.
Yeah.
And probably the church as well. I know my father always enjoyed a good church service.
Yeah.
If it was a proper...
Yeah, for the music as well,
Music, yes. And this playing, there was still, at that time, people played instruments at home.
Mm. Yeah. Great. Okay. You might not want to go into this, and feel free not to, but in the archive there's some correspondence of Daphne's where she refers to having a difficult time around the after the death of her mother and the kind of some wrangling with the estate. I don't know exactly how she phrased it or something. But if you don't want to go into it, Don't worry.
I don't know.
You don't know anything about it? No. Okay. We also
I realise that there were tensions, but I don't know.
You don't know
exactly
the details?
I don't know the details.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I don't particularly want to. Either.
No, that's fair enough. Yeah. I was also wondering, I know we discussed earlier about her potentially sort of other possessions which may have not ended up in the archive, and particularly I'd be interested in, I know a lot, you said there were several burglaries at the house after she died, but there are some references to there's certainly a reference to having a CD player in an insurance document sort of from later in the 90s.
Right.
And I was wondering if any of the CDs or if she had vinyl or cassettes or anything like that, if
I
you knew
anything
about
it.
Yeah, so it's one to follow on another day.
Martin
again, yeah.
So all the kind of house stuff is really Martin, is it?
Yeah, that's good to know, because,
There are some quite huge gaps where you would assume, like the fact that there are no, well, there's four books, three of which I think we've collected off people who are currently at Tower Folly.
Right.
But
be careful, because I know, be careful about that, because as far as Martin's concerned, I know this, he cleared out the house and there was nothing left.
Right. Yeah.
So are you sure they are her books?
Yeah, because the thing is actually,
because she's so
meticulous,
right?
And the references all match up
to
the editions
so
of the
actually.
Books, and they sort of wouldn't
so
be.
They must have been stashed somewhere.
Like,
so they were found somewhere
well,
in the
is,
house.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to. Yeah, make any assumptions. I just wonder, like, because there are certain things that you would just imagine would be with it and wouldn't have very much value for someone to steal, like, ultimately. Like, just bits and pieces of some of the paperwork, and like the Noon's book. There's just a few holes, really, I suppose, which may just be things that have just been lost over time or, you know, got damp. And got
or maybe we're in a box with some stuff that got pinched.
Houses, you have to take some really
exactly. Exactly. As you do when you're doing an archive as well, to be honest, you can't keep everything. But in fact, with this archive we have.
Well, if you did a good first sweep.
Right.
Yeah. Everything's been kept past that point since I've been working on it. You did do a really good first sweep.
I was wondering as well, did you visit Daphne much sort of later in her life when she was working on the computer?
No.
No. So
my brother did, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's over in Canada.
Right. Okay. Maybe I could. Would he want to be asked about it?
He'd be quite happy,
yeah. Perhaps I could get his email and Skype him or something.
Yeah.
That would be great if I could take those details.
Yeah.
Okay.
Would you say that she became more reclusive as she got older, or
I didn't
not
know
as
she
reclusive?
Was older.
Right.
I mean, to me, she was always so wrapped up in her work. I know she got out, but you could almost have said she probably always was.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
Yeah, I think reclusive may not a good choice of word there,
because
it's like
she could only work at night, because at that time you couldn't turn the telephone off.
Right.
So she'd be working. If she worked during the day and the phone went, she'd record the phone record the ring, the bell. She'd stop the tape recorder, go to answer the phone.
And the
come
traffic
back,
as well, she mentioned.
Yeah, go
as
back
well.
A bit. And then obviously she'd hear that bell again. She'd say, oh, telephone's gone again. So the whole. So to a certain extent.
Yeah, she had no choice.
Yeah.
And that's probably because when she was at the BBC in the kind of early days of Radiophonic Workshop, things set up for her being the radiophonic person, she had to work at night there as well, because they wouldn't give her any other time. So
and also
she was
it was
night,
about
she
getting...
She was a night out. I mean, she was a night bird.
Which therefore
she had
takes
to be.
You out of, takes you out of kind of conventional timings of society, I suppose, quite a bit. Well, it does. That happens to me as well. It really does. But,
and then you
yeah.
didn't have your all-night convenience
yeah.
convenience stores and things.
Yeah.
So when was the last time you saw Daphne? Can you remember?
Well, she came... When did I last... She took me to the Mermaid. Probably the last time, when she did Rocket's Version Major.
Mm. Oh, really?
When was that?
That was 70 something.
I think it was while I was at college down at Roehampton, which was sort of 69 to 72. I think that was probably the last time I saw
it. Yeah, in the early 70s. Because it was after Edinburgh and it was after that stuff.
Okay.
And the Queen Elizabeth Hall thing. So.
Mm. It was about three rows.
Did you enjoy that? Because I've just read the book and it made no sense to me, barely. I mean, little sense.
It was really the place, the Mermaid. I mean, and we were three rows back from the front, but it didn't mean I make a wonderful sound around this concrete area. I can remember the sounds, but what actually happened on stage, I can't remember.
Yeah, that's a compliment to her then, I guess.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But it was a very simple set. Yeah, it was all open.
Right.
I think.
No, it's Fred Goodwin, isn't it? That's who wrote it. Fred Goodwin. Yeah.
I thought.
And,
no, it was.
Is that the other one?
Rockets from Major Main. Fred Hoyle.
Fred Hoyle. Yes. Goodwin. Oh, that's someone else that she wrote to.
I think I'm probably wrapping up quite soon, James. Have you got anything else you want to add?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose one other question, which feel free not to answer, is whether or not she was single her whole life.
And
whether or not that was a kind of choice or not.
No,
because there's a couple of fairly odd photos in the archive of just sort of random men, unidentified, sitting in a deck chair or something.
Right.
And it's just, it's one of those things that's not really that relevant to the work it's that either of us are doing, but it's just sort of background because she seems to have had some very, very close friendships with certain people.
Right.
Where it's just, and then the friendships just stop.
Right.
Dead.
Right.
And it's just trying to figure out why, I suppose. Not that it really matters.
Mm.
You sort of wonder with these things and just,
But without anything else to go on, all you can do is speculate, which is not very helpful in terms of PhD research. It's kind of speculation's not what they're after at all.
There are people in the world who have friendships, they form early on and they continue.
Yeah.
And some people are like that. Some people go along with friendships, which I'm sure you know people.
There are people who just have short. Fall out with close friends and they don't speak again.
Or they just, for some reason, do just keep with different people throughout their lives.
Mm.
Not everybody has their friendships all the way through their lives.
Mm. No,
that's true.
So, and she's probably one end of that spectrum, towards one end of the spectrum.
And she's certainly a very strong character, I mean, by all accounts. Someone who's. Extremely determined and quite a forceful personality in some respects. So I guess that is also not surprising. If I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Well, yes, I mean, and also probably she was quite an intense person.
Yeah.
She was so strong and so interesting and, that there's some people you can't take in huge.
Yeah.
You can only take in small bites.
Mm. I think also, absolute speculation as well, but just a general comment on, you have to take into account the times where perhaps men were not necessarily looking for such a strong woman that would perhaps be quite, it was, that wasn't really what the fashion dictated, was it? Certainly, so it's kind of, that's... My mum tells me of times when she was an undergraduate and... that at Cambridge, it wasn't really, it still wasn't the done thing for women to have opinions about things. People would put them down, if that was, and this was She's, you know, a generation below Daphne, more like your generation.
Yes.
So, it's, you know, that is an important factor, isn't it? It's kind of, yeah, you can't just sort of say, oh, it's a mystery. Like, it's, these things were prevalent.
And also, I mean, I couldn't have, she was so interested in so many things, I couldn't imagine her of being a good little housewife.
No, no.
Children.
Yeah, actually, that's when I was interviewing this chap who was visiting her later. He said that, you know, that basically housework wasn't done for the, like, it was just the computer, the work,
yeah.
Some very basic sustenance,
yeah.
Perhaps the goat's milk and like, but not much either. And it was just the work, the sound, the computer, the programming, and blinkers, really. Yeah. That's his impression. Yeah.
I remember turning up once with my parents and my mother going back into the kitchen and saying, well, you got in, coming out this afternoon, and saying, well, all you got in the kitchen, in your cupboard, is half a dozen eggs.
Mm.
She said, well, what else do you need? Five a week on that.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I know it was a joke. She actually meant it as a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
But to my mother,
yeah.
My mother probably didn't see the funny side of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a truth in that as well.
Yeah, that's certainly the impression I got from this other chat. Yeah.
Which is why she was quite happy with this old-fashioned kitchen stuck on the back of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, it was definitely the centre of that house was the studio.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else we should have asked you? Is there anything that you'd like to feel like you'd like to add?
You were asking, to be got down the bit I was saying earlier about listening to the music. The quartet.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
So, there was when Daphne was growing up. Where did her kind of musical influences come from, as such?
Well, I know that her mother, her parents played quartets with their friends. Her mother, Ida, played the violin. Father, I for sure, played the cello. I have a vague recollection of singing with the cello once. And in the evenings, my father told me that Daphne and he, John, would be sit up on the landing, listening to the quartets, to her parents playing. And that was a very strong memory for him.
Right.
And how they were always ready to scarf back into
bed. Yeah.
But they never got caught.
So that would be early 30s, I guess.
Yes.
Sometime around then.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably when she was, she would have had to have been 5, wouldn't she? Father would have been 10. And obviously there's the stories about her playing the piano and trying to change the notes.
Yeah, prepare the pianos. Yeah.
The sound of them. And transmitting her playing from one room to another.
Yeah.
See, well, that's the sort of thing would have done, presumably, happened on school holidays when
Arthur they were all
discovered
back.
About radio waves and things.
Mm.
Bits of equipment, all that, she would have been, you get a picture of her being fascinated with the sort of,
the cat's technical
whiskers
things.
And,
yeah.
And all these sort of things.
Mm.
All this technical, and what her brothers were managing to do with them.
Mm.
It's all got to be a strong influence, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Is there anything else? Could you just give a few adjectives which might sum up Daphne or him? Is that a really cheesy question?
That's
the classic.
They
broke the mold. Never to be another one. And that applies to all three siblings.
Right. Yeah.
Did you say, Colin?
Yeah.
Well, they're very similar as a three. Like, would you very easily? You know how sometimes you can just say like, those are three siblings, 100% in the way they behave.
They probably could to a certain extent, but. Daphne, well, it was once said that if the three of them had got together, it would have been fantastic because You'd had the music, my father for the mechanical, and the eldest brother, Arthur, for the money.
Oh, really?
And if the three of them...
No, he was quite shrewd, was he?
Well, he ended up, he was an accountant, I think he was an accountant at Unilever.
Right.
But during the war, he was an accountant in a different form.
Mm.
He used to go into factories where they were given, allowed to have steel for making whatever they said they were going to make.
Yeah.
But of course, the black market was very lucrative.
Mm.
So he used to go into these factories and work out how much, you know, they'd have been allowed so much steel in, and he had to prove that it all went into the
what
they said it was going into.
Mm.
So he used to have to go and weigh bits of machinery and things and check that what came in one end actually went out the other end.
Aeroplanes or guns or whatever it was. Yeah.
And the other bits of equipment. And after the war too, when it was still...
Yeah, still rationing. Yeah. And
so he did all that sort of thing as well.
Head for figures.
I have one other question. Are you surprised at, say, this situation now, having happened, the exhibition and...
No.
Not at all?
No. No one always knew this. Daphne was an interesting lady.
Mm.
Do you think she knew that? If you know what I mean. Because I'm fascinated... The other thing, part of my thesis, which is very separate to all of this, but... As an artist working with archiving, the notion of archiving her records, her carbon copying every letter, her writing down everything, it's like, and the way everything is organised, it's almost as if she did it for someone to archive it. Like, and I've met people like this recently, artists who have got to a certain point in their life and organised their affairs, even though no one's approached them, to make sure that their legacy as such is kept intact.
My guess is that she didn't. She was just like that. But I have just given her great-grandfather's diaries and her grandfather's diaries to University College Dublin.
Right.
So there is a record-keeping in the family. And also her uncle, we've given his diaries, actually, at Cambridge.
Right.
But they are all very factual.
Yeah.
Mm.
The diaries are from Ireland. The diaries went to Dublin. It was because her great-grandfather went out to the west of Ireland as a land agent and farmer for an absentee landlord. And the diaries then start, 1853. The first set of diaries, just one-liners, always about the weather, always includes notes on weather and a lot about farming. But then grandfather's diaries, there's more detail there. But the interesting thing is, although he was living in an area of Ireland where there was a lot of grassroots activity, he has not dropped one name. He must have known what was going on.
Mm.
It's all about what the family did, where he went, all things that would have been in the public, almost in the public domain anyway. He's written it almost as if he could have stood up in court and said, "That's what I did that day."
Mm.
And no, I didn't know what was going on in all these underground movements down the road. And the ones, the uncle who went to... So that's why I could give them, actually. I couldn't have given them otherwise if she had said all sorts of things. But the ones, her uncle, who's ended up chief engineer in the Northwest Frontier, that's now Pakistan, right up in Kashmir area,
right there.
And those, if you look up on the Cambridge University site, they definitely say, you know, it is factual, just what he did.
Mm.
Who he met.
So very little opinion and everything.
Very little.
Because that's very different to Daphne. Certainly in her correspondence, there's a lot of opinion.
But that's quite,
I should show you the slides that weren't projected, diaries, but there's some good pieces.
In her diaries, there isn't much.
No, that's it's quite factual.
No,
yeah,
opinion.
It's more
purely factual when you think about it.
Yeah.
Or even in her notes and
yeah,
there's
but in her correspondence, there's a lot of
definitely definitely. Very strong opinion, that's, actually. Yeah. Stronger than, you know.
Yeah,
you
this expect. Is almost as if with my great grandfather, the longer diaries in Ireland, almost as if there ought to be a parallel diary, which has been lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of, there's sort of empty spaces, and you just think, what was he thinking?
Mm.
But very much this public persona and private.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, we should show you the slides, because unfortunately they weren't... Should we call it a day for the interview? It's really fascinating. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Don't
sorry
it's ever so much.
It's been...